Okay, guys, a schedule change. Mirth Hashem, I'm traveling in a couple hours to the States. I'll be in some of your schools. I'll send regards to your teachers. I'll give them all good reports, and we'll talk about financial arrangements when I come back. If you want me to give good reports for you, you'll have to bribe me a little bit. Some of you are going to have to bribe me more than others, but I'll do my best to make it sound like you're doing well. And give your vein much needed nachas. And Mirth Hashem, next Tuesday I'll be in the States. Two Tuesdays in Mirth Hashem I'll be back. So we're just going to miss one shiur, Parshas Vayechi. We'll see, maybe later in the year we'll try to return to some of the themes of Parshas Vayechi. Where are the extra sheets for the walkers on? Okay, put it down. Okay. I want to discuss an issue that's more holistic than Parshas Vayigash. It unfolds over the last couple of Parshios, the second half. Or certainly the last quarter of Sefer Bereishis is dominated by the internal rivalries and sibling competition between Yosef and Yehuda. And it's not just personalities, but it's templates of leadership. And ultimately, these two types of leadership are complementary. That's why Yosef doesn't defeat Yehuda. Yehuda doesn't defeat Yosef. Ultimately, in the days of the first Beis Hamikdash, these two models of leadership coexist, complement one another. Malchus Yehuda is driven by Shevet Yehuda. Malchus Yisrael is by and large driven by Shevet Yosef and Asher Ephraim. And these contrasting styles are meant to be sustained in perpetuity from the end of days, Mashiach ben Yosef, Mashiach ben David. So evidently we're not dealing with a face-off between two people, but a face-off between two different styles and two different leadership styles, and we're meant to appreciate the importance of each. Yosef's leadership style is obvious, and his wisdom, his belief, his faith, his ability to conquer his Yitzhahara, his self-control, his relationship with the Kodesh Baruch, we've spoken about it extensively. I'd like to dedicate some time to a more nuanced portrait of Yehuda. And I'd like to contrast Yehuda for you with Yosef. It's not meant in any way to dismiss or in any way undercut Yosef's model, but just to highlight who Yehuda was. And I want to highlight three differences between Yehuda and Yosef. Yosef is a very charismatic person. He has a certain charm that enchants people. And that charm is on display in the very beginning of Parshas Vayeshev in a literary pun. He was shepherding his brothers with the sheep. Was he shepherding the sheep or was he shepherding his brothers? The answer is both. It's a double entendre. And the same influence he exerted over the sheep to lead them and to influence them. Of course, a shepherd exerts absolute and unconditional control over the sheep. He had that same charm and that same kinetic energy expressed to his brothers. V'hu ro'eh es achav batzom. And he's a dreamer. And people dream of great passion and are in touch with their dreams and live in a world of dreams. And Rav Lichtenstein would always quote for us, and Rav Amital to be it. Rav Lichtenstein, I think, would quote a poem, and Rav Amital would quote a Gemara. The Gemara says in Brachos that if you don't dream in 30 days, you have to be Gozer Tainus. So we're not really that involved in making up and augmenting Tanios, but at least according to the Gemara, if you don't have a dream in 30 days, don't get all spooked out, or you all of a sudden go make a Tainus. But Rav Amital saw that as a metaphor for if you don't dream, and you don't desire, and you don't strive for more. And Rav Lichtenstein quoted some 16th century Platonist thinker, I don't know who he's quoting, what is man without his dreams? It was the same idea. And I hope that we've given you a heavy dosage of dreams, and I hope we've been able to help you reorient your dreams, in addition to everything you've dreamt of before yeshiva, to be able to prioritize Avodas Hashem at the top of that pantheon, at the top of that pyramid. So often people say, well, now I'm going to be asking this question, I have to answer this question 400 times over the next week. Why should I come to yeshiva? Why should I come to yeshiva at Har Tzion? Shit me now. Forget it. Oh God, I don't want to answer the question again. But sometimes, in fact, I see my job as dual. Sometimes I try to encourage boys to come to yeshiva at Har Tzion. Sometimes I try to discourage boys from coming to Har Tzion. Sometimes it doesn't work. But also, sometimes I'll just try to speak to a boy who's not that excited about yeshiva in general and try to excite him. Sometimes, very often, it's a boy that is a good candidate for Har Tzion, but is inhibited. And sometimes it's just a boy who just doesn't fit Har Tzion, but l'shem shemayim, I want to get him to try to experience yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. And sometimes the boy says, Rabbi, I'm religious, I'm Orthodox, I keep mitzvahs, I keep kosher, why should I spend a year, why should I waste the year of my life? So first of all, it's like a dagger to my heart when he uses the W word about Torah. How could you use that word? I don't say this to him. Why should I waste a year? Or if anyone like dares to use the following phrase in an interview, I'm almost like a heart attack. I have to fake it that I'm not having a heart attack. Well, I'm here to apply for my gap year. No, this isn't your gap year. This is your year. The rest is your gap life between your year in Olam Haba and the rest of your life in Olam Haba. The rest is your gap life, not your gap year. Me in Olam Haba. Don't say that. Breathe in. Breathe out. Yoga. I take my yoga breaths, make a little smile for the camera. Sure, apply for your gap year. And I'm like sitting there, like squeezing myself on the table, pulling my shorts up. Anyway, so like it's very hard for me. This is a hard week, guys. You gotta have a Rachmanis over here. But anyway, what were we talking about? So we're talking about dreams. And I thought, well, I think you're from, and I think you're religious, and let's assume that you can maintain your orthodoxy in a very challenging world, but are you passionate about religion? Do you really care about it? Do you want to excel in religion? Do you have aspirations in religion? Do you have aspirations of being a Talmud Chacham? And very often, the boy looks at me like, what are you talking about? So then I pretty much know I may not be right for the yeshiva, but I'm trying to build those aspirations. And Yosef is that dreamer. And his dreams are obviously both spiritual and materialistic. He dreams of stars and he dreams of bundles, and he's trying to advance the family. And he believes that he's been given a mandate from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he's able to exert that charm on everyone who comes into his path, whether it's his brothers, his father who delivers Exones Pasim, the wife of his master, unfortunately, all the other prisoners, all the other workers, ultimately the king of Egypt, all the young girls in Mitzrayim, everyone is absolutely enthralled with this person. He has this charm, and sometimes you have people that just have charm and are way with people. And you know what? If you don't have that, you can get that also. Obviously, as with many people, it's inborn. But you can also acquire personal skills and interpersonal skills. And if you're more of an introverted person, if you're less socially adept, don't throw in the towel and say, well, I'm fated for a life of playing chess. I mean, you could be a person that has a lot of... Not that chess is bad. You could be a person that has a lot of skills and try to build on those skills. And I think even in yeshiva, and certainly in the years afterwards, we're trying to build in social opportunities to build those skills, because you're going to grow from your surroundings. You're going to grow from your environments. It's not just to be a social person to win Mr. Congeniality, but it's to be able to embed yourself in. I was reading this really harrowing article last night in the Wall Street Journal about loneliness and people of advanced age, and the people are really living alone, completely alone, without any children, without any wives or husbands, without any contact. There's an aide that comes in this story once a week to help clean up the home, and this one goes to the church that there's no community, and researchers are now trying to study how dangerous this is to actual health. And they've claimed it's more dangerous than obesity, and more dangerous than diabetes, and more dangerous than smoking cigarettes. So it's not just to have a social life in the way that, but it's to have a social life, and ultimately with the right people who will reinforce. And believe it or not, as much as you're in that pursuit of authenticity and genuine avodas Hashem and genuine identity, a lot of your avodas Hashem is social. A lot of your avodas Hashem is just being with the right group of people. And I mean, even look back on your experience. I hope we've provided a healthy dose for Jim and Joe. And I imagine you can compare your experience in this yeshiva to your peers' experiences in other yeshiva and find yeshivas that are more social and more of a conforming peer pressure. And possibly with less of those, is probably less of that peer pressure to perform. But I hope you can all identify that this is a place that you've gained, not just from the great Rebbeim, but also from the boys who hopefully have exerted. I don't just mean the boys sitting next to you from your high school in New York or in Philadelphia, but the boys in general, in the sense that you're part of a community. So that's Yosef. And Yehuda is very different. Yehuda doesn't exert any of that charm. There's none of that charisma. He doesn't enchant anyone. No one's excited by his presence. He flies under the radar. But he exerts and exhibits a very, very different trait of leadership. That's what I'd like to talk about tonight. And I want to caution you about that word. That is probably the most exploitative word that I hear being used today. And you want to excite youngsters and people your age about a program or a seminar, young leadership and future leadership and leaders of tomorrow, and just you really are being, you're being brainwashed. And it's just like all of a sudden you say the word leadership, take me to your leader. And just like, all of a sudden it's like this hot buzzword, and you'll do anything to be a leader. And I'm not saying that it's insignificant, but I'm asking just to be careful. I'd like you to make lists to yourself. What does it take to be a leader? It's not necessarily speaking of fancy seminars and having a fancy teacher come and speak to you. There are traits of leadership. I've spoken about it extensively. We'll mention some of them tonight. But some of the traits that are being sold to you as under the halo of leadership are completely counter-indicated to leadership. That's not what leadership's about. And just be careful that you study it like you'd study anything else, because it's a very enchanting term, and it will lead you into investments that may not be worthwhile, into people, quite frankly, who will speak in the name of leadership but may not necessarily be suited for leadership. So it's a much, much more complicated parsha. But hopefully we've changed you not to be simplistic and not to be formulaic and not to just be reflexive and just respond Pavlovian to certain stimuli, to think about what the traits of leadership are. With Yehuda, his leadership is not expressed by the way he charms people. His leadership is expressed by the way he bears responsibility. And he doesn't pass off responsibility to others. And in episode after episode, he's in the center, taking charge, being a leader, as they say in Israel, in the Rosh Gadol, And there's an old adage, if you want something done, ask a busy person. And it's a counterintuitive adage, because if they're busy, they can't take care of it. But if you're busy, then you like to perform tasks, and you don't delegate, and you don't pass the buck, and you take responsibility. You take responsibility for your failures. And you hear that there's a lot of that taking of responsibility. It starts at the pit. It starts with Yosef. And I think Yehuda was born into it, because he's the fourth. And there's a definite transition in the modality of the family when Yehuda is born. And Leah recognizes that Hapam Odes Hashem, she has abdicated or abandoned the petitional, ugly duckling, disfavored woman role. She's always wondering about how Hashem is accepting her tefillos, or whether Yaakov will pay more attention to her after Levi. Now that Yehuda is born, there's a poise. Hapam Odes Hashem. Now I can look back and step back, and Hapam, now this is Hapam, this is a moment in Leah's transition, and she's no longer articulating or streaming her experiences through whether her tefillos are accepted by HaKadosh Baruch Hu or the Yaakov will be more or less attuned to her. Now she stands on her own 2 feet, as it were, and looks at HaKadosh Baruch Hu and says, Hapam Odes Hashem. So I think he's born into it. I think he demonstrates that at the pit, where, again, it seems very Machiavellian, where it makes him profit, but ultimately he's responsible for assisting in the aversion of murder. At some level, he and Reuven are the two, and there's a whole separate conversation of Yehuda versus Reuven, but he and Reuven are the people that steer the conspiracy away from murder. Let's say Shimon was probably, as Chazal tells us, was probably the instigator to murder. That's why Yosef imprisons him a little bit later. But it's much more powerfully on display in Parashas Mikes and ultimately Parashas Vayigash. In Mikes, he's the one that convinces his father ultimately, and he's the one that speaks in positive terms when Shimon was all full of doom and gloom, and you'll kill my 2 sons if Binyamin doesn't return. And Yehuda says, "Benakuma v'nechiev elo namos, we're going to live, and I'm going to bear responsibility, and if not, I will pay the price for chatasi lecha kol hayamin if Binyamin doesn't return." And then, of course, in this week's parsha, they got shit up and Yehuda Yomer. Basically, it's the last minute of the game. Essentially, all the chips are on the table. They have an uphill battle. There's no leverage. They've been caught red-handed. And something clicks in Yehuda. I spoke about this morning when I talked about the Ishbitzer. It's an incredible, abrupt shift between the helplessness and the despair and the surrender of Parshas Mikates. And then Yehuda Avadim will be your Avadim. And all of a sudden, this rallying and resurgence of Parshas Vayigash. It's just spectacular to see that transition in a human being, and certainly in Yehuda. And you see this on display in the end of the parsha as well, where Yehuda is sent to Goshen to be the advanced scout, to build the toehold, to build the foundation, the infrastructure, going to Rashi to establish a yeshiva. So evidently, it's Yehuda who doesn't. We never see Yehuda's impact on anyone else. Yehuda's never attracting people. Yehuda's never exciting people. If anything, his interpersonal, I'm not saying he had four personal skills, but the interpersonal moments we witness between him and Tamar and between him and his financial partners in Parshas Vayeshev are not spectacularly successful. There's a lot of, he has to hold off his daughter-in-law and say, wait until my younger son grows older. And it's not as if all of a sudden Yehuda shines in the personality department. But he does shine as someone that bears responsibility. And nowhere more so than in Parshas Vayeshev, because part of bearing responsibility, and this is so, so crucial, and it's real, real leadership. I don't know if this will ever be in your leadership seminar, but real leadership is demonstrating fallibility. If you don't demonstrate fallibility, you are handicapping people in life. One of the most liberating parts of life is to admit the capacity to fail, that human beings are flawed, and if you fail, there's nothing wrong. You accept responsibility, you try harder. And in most cases, you didn't fail because of any malicious intent or any indolence. You failed because we can't always accomplish our goals. And you just ask yourself a test question. How many times in your life, don't answer, don't raise your hand and tell me, it's a private question, but I'd like to personalize the experience. How many times in your life did you see your role models admit their failure and just take responsibility and say, I'm sorry, I failed. Your parent, your teacher, whoever they are, your older sibling, don't answer the question like it would be invasive. You can't imagine how important that is in any context. That's corporate culture 101. Any corporate culture will succeed if people at the top of the food chain take responsibility, and demonstrate. Any family will succeed if a parent doesn't need to put themselves on a pedestal of perfection for the children, but is able to ease into a more authentic role of fallibility. It's so hard because you like to see, and you like to live in a world in which your children view you as perfect. Yeah, but that lasts till they're 13. When they're 14, they realize you're not perfect. And if you can't transition them into a more adult relationship with you, in the sense that, well, I'm not the perfect father that you envision. I'm just a human being trying my hardest and love me as such. That love shrivels very fast because it doesn't hold up to the disparity between the narrative of their youth and the reality as they grow older. And it's so important as a parent, and it's so important for a relationship, it's so important for a spouse, the ability just to say, it's my fault, I'm to blame, and I'll bear responsibility, and I'll clean up the mess as best I can. It's just two words, Sakamimeni. Those two words are two of the most powerful words in all the parts of Sefer Bereishis. It's not powerful to win, to triumph in war, it's not power. It's powerful just to bear responsibility and concede your vulnerability. That's all about this as well. If you take a look at source number, in the back of the page, it says Tosef and Brachos. It's two deos, I combine them. One deos says, because of this two-word admission. That's why Yehuda's up. I can't get any clearer than that. The next time you're at a leadership seminar, raise your hand and say, I've got a good trait for leadership. It's called admitting fallibility. Where do I get it from? Tosef and Brachos. Because it's Sakhtam Imen, it's in the first Tosefta. And then the Tosefta continues, I don't think it's a different Shita, I think it's the same Shita, with Neha Nava, because he's humble. And I think humility speaks to the ability to admit your failure. If you are egotistical, and you need people's attention, and you need people's adulation and admiration, it's harder to admit your failure. If you're a humble person, you're not clinging to people's opinion of you, you've got a healthy internal self-esteem, and you don't need to operate on other people's approval, so it's not that difficult to admit your failure. I try to find people in life that aren't seeking your approval, because those are the real people that will talk to you frontally and will speak the hard words and the important words. People are looking for your approval and not speaking to you. They're speaking to your vote. They're speaking to get your to win your attention, to win your validation. People that don't need or care about your validation, those are the people that care about you and care about your validation. Not in a way that's offsetting and arrogant and off-putting, but in a way that they've got lives and they're here to help you, but not because they need you to love them and to admire them, to put you on a pedestal. So it's the humility of Yehuda that allows him to say, Sadkanimeni. And what's fascinating about this contrast of different leadership styles is that the same icon is used very differently for Yosef than it is for Yehuda. Because for Yosef, there's an element of dress and of clothing that constantly surfaces from Parshas Vayeshev through Parshas Miketz. And every time Yosef gets dressed, it's a fashion statement. And of course, using modern terms. Something about Yosef's clothing is riveting. Everyone's dancing around Yosef's clothing. From the Kesones Pasin, which clearly gets the attention of his brothers in a very, very negative way, to the clothing, and you can't get an iconic portrait more potent than this. Source number one, part base. But to Peseo Bevigdo, she holds on to Yosef's beged. Now, she's not holding on to Yosef's beged. Presumably, Yosef's beged was on his body. She was holding on to Yosef. Yet the Torah describes it as holding on to his beged. So there's this message that it's Yosef's clothing and appearance. Peseo Bevigdo. Shech Lo'imi. That's her demand. That's her seduction. Vayazo Bevigdo Beyada. Don't just read what's happening technically. Read this metaphorically. He walks away from the clothing. At some point, his ability to withstand the seduction is his ability to walk away from his beged experience, his ability to walk away from this moment of charisma. Because this is not a moment of charisma. This charisma will be very, very dangerous. So, vayazo bigdo biyada vayanas veitze achutza. Vayehi kirosa ki aza bigdo biyada vayanas achutza. Why does the Torah constantly write the word bigdo? Why is this the milah mancha in this section? Ve'ekra, then when she describes the events a few seconds later, Vayazo bigdo etzli vayanis ve'etzi achutza. So the Yosef of the Ksones Pasin is now the Yosef of Begadim, and now in a very, very challenging form, it's not just eliciting hatred, but eliciting sexual seduction. And at the same level, a little bit later in Parshas Miketz, now the Begadim are a sign that he's transitioned from being a slave in a pit to being a king. And I understand Parshas Miketz and Vayeshev a lot better, having visited European dungeons. They want to visit a European dungeon. When we read the Bor, of Parshas Vayeshev, we think about a Bor. You go into your backyard and you think of a Bor. What's so bad? Maybe a little bit deeper, a little bit wider. You ever been inside a European dungeon? It's really eerie. You're talking about a dungeon that is dug 5 or 6 levels beneath the earth, completely dark, and the only access point is a little sphere covered by this huge metal object with a little cutout. You have to basically wiggle and corkscrew your way through this little access hole. Just, you don't escape a dungeon. It's not like the escape from Alcatraz, all the movies you've seen. There's no out. You don't get out. You're living like a rat your whole life. And I only understood by Yeshua Ben Mikkei time he visited, because in my mind, my little, juvenile mind, I thought he was in a pit, he was in a base of sars, he was behind bars. What's so bad? You get visitation rights and you get to your graduate degree. What's the big deal? Kosher food and daf yomi. But you come to these dungeons and you see the darkness and the gloom, and basically you're lost. You're buried in the earth. It's a whole subculture, you and the rats. So he has to transition. So Vayishlach Paro, Vayikra Es Yosef, Vayirtzu Min HaBor, Vayigalach, Vayichalef Simosav, Vayavar Al Paro. Now, we can infer that he changed his clothing, right? He's been in prison, he has to shower. Why does the Torah have to report it? Because the changing of the clothing is the changing of his identity, because his identity is always expressed through clothing and the impact will have on others. Now, Yehuda has only one moment in which his clothing are meaningful, but the function of Yehuda's clothing is completely different than the function of Yosef's clothing. So it's number 5. Hey, Vayomer Mari Avona She'etei Lach. He says, what collateral should I give? Again, this is a seedy moment. Unbeknownst to Yehuda, this is a prostitute. And unbeknownst to Yehuda, well, he knows it's a prostitute, but unbeknownst to Yehuda, this is his daughter-in-law. But if you scrape away the context and you just look at the core is responsibility. Remember that word, Erevon. The first time we see that word used in the Torah. In fact, there's a halacha called Arev. And it's a really strange halacha. If Akiva wants to borrow money from Avi, and Avi's laughing his eyes out while we're lying, Akiva, I'll never see that money. Now you say, you know what, Avi? If Akiva defaults, I'll pay you. Give him the money. I'm called the Arev. I'm called the guarantor. And I'm Chayev Tavi, even though I don't make a Maisikin, I don't make a Chalipin. How could you create a Chiyev without a Maisikin? It's a shocking halacha. It's derived from Yehuda. Not necessarily this pasuk, but we'll see a different pasuk. But this pasuk has that word. Maha Eravon, Asher Etin Lach. Matomer, and she responds, Chosamcha, your insignia. Ufisilachat. Fisilachat doesn't mean your strings. Yehuda didn't have a string collection. It means his clothing. Ufisilachat. Umatcha sheviyadach. And even look at the very pedestrian way that Yehuda's clothing is referred to. It's not even called a baguette. It's very functional. It's a psil. It's strings. It obviously wasn't wearing a string. He was wearing a lot of strings woven together into a baguette. But it's not the kesonis pasiv, and it's not the vichalef simlosav. For Yosef, it's a simla. And it's a kesonet, and it's pasin, and it's a woman holding onto his clothing. If you do that, it's pasil, which is associated with other signs of responsibility. Your staff, your insignia. What is your word? Your word, your staff, your leadership. It's a very, very striking contrast. And if you're looking for the reason that Yehuda was successful in persuading Yaakov where Yosef fails, it's staring you right in the eyes. Reuven fails, and Yehuda has a little secret word that he knows will get to Yaakov. Source number Gimel. Vayomer Yehuda el Yisrael, this is now Parshas Mikates. Shilcha nar iti, v'nakuma, v'nelecha, v'nechia, v'lon amos. Here's the positive language. Very important trait of leadership, positive language. Got to be the calm in the eye of the storm. Life's a storm. People panic. Leadership is calm, confidence, there are answers, there are solutions. You don't want to push the panic button. Want to be a leader, you have to radiate calm and radiate a sense of the ability to overcome adversity, even when you don't feel it inside. Rav Amital told us that after the Yom Kippur War, when 8 boys were killed in the yeshiva, this is a relatively small yeshiva. He said, basically, I didn't have it. I didn't have it inside. I'm using my terminology. I just didn't have the strength. People talk about the fact that he went to Rav Lichtenstein and gave him the keys and said, you run the yeshiva. I can't run the yeshiva anymore. But he said, and there's a video clip of this, he says, I had to be strong. I had to exude strength and confidence because so many people needed that from me. And it's not fake. If it's manipulative or deceitful, and you say one thing, you just summon it. You say, I've got to radiate that, even though I don't feel it inside, but Got to find that place that can feel it and can express it. It's another important trait of leadership, just to say, well, we'll solve the problem. Even when you know there are solutions, because you'll find some solution, but to intensify the sense of crisis, it's not real leadership. So Yehuda speaks positive. And then he says, source number, Gimel, line 2, Anochi Erevenu. That's the word. That's Yehuda's word. Erevam. Anochi Erevenu. This is where the Gemara in Bava Basra derives the halacha of Arev. You'll learn Arev, Emirat Hashem, countless times in Shas, not so much in Gittin, but in Kiddusha and in Bava Basra and Bava Metziah. It all comes from this pasuk, Anochi Erevenu. It's a Gzeres HaKasuk. And an Arev can be mischayev without my Sikhenu. Miyadit Tevakshem. Next leadership seminar, you're out. Raise your hand and say, the first pasuk. The buck stops here. I'll be personally responsible. You can come to me. I'll take care of it. I'm not going to pass it off to other people. I'm going to be the Rosh Gadol. I will plan, I will execute, and I'll finish it. Remember, in the early 90s, a little bit older than you, I was just newly married. I spent a lot of time with my wife, who was then in my wife's family, who were then living in Edison, New Jersey, Highland Park, New Jersey. And the community was very involved in those days in collecting clothing and furniture and goods for Russian emigres. That was right when the Soviet Union was allowing Russian Jews to emigrate both to America, to Israel. So a lot of influx of Russians into the community. And I remember every Sunday, I wasn't there during the week, but I was there on Shabbos a lot, so I stayed over for Sunday morning davening. Every Sunday I was in shul, the Sunday morning davening was probably the most well-attended davening in any community. And someone made an announcement, and whoever has clothing or furniture to donate, people started rumbling, hustling, bustling in the background. Everyone has extra clothing. Everyone has extra furniture lying around, especially in Rakhshem comfortable communities. But then I remember there were some people, either because there were announcements or some people volunteered to actually pick up the clothing and to drive and to deliver and to... It's not going to help anyone if you have extra clothing. Okay, so how do you get clothing from point A to point B? Clothing don't have legs. I mean, they do. But they can't walk. All of a sudden, they're not going to relocate themselves. The sufferers are going to get up, and this isn't Dr. Seuss novel. It's almost like going to show up at the guy's house. Someone's got to get on their hands and knees and get a garbage bag and collect the clothing and move it. And it's just, it struck me. There are small-minded people and there are large-minded people. Small-minded people say, well, I've got clothing. This large-minded people say, okay, there are three steps to this process. How is it going to happen? Even if you can't attend to all of them personally, you find someone that will. And how do you complete tasks? And how do you compartmentalize them? What are they... That's real leadership, the execution gap. Getting from point A to point G, rather than say, oh, this is my responsibility, I'll stay, that's called bureaucratic small-mindedness. I'll stay within the cells, the small cellularized world that I inhabit, and I'll deal with my issue, and I'll stamp your paper when it comes to it. That's classic bureaucratic myopia, as opposed to large-mindedness, that you've got to advance the situation and execute it fully. And Yehuda takes full responsibility, but he understands that this is going to resonate with Yaakov. Because listen to what he says. Anochi Erevenu, Yadi Tevakshenu. Who used those words? Well, cheat sheet. Another way of leadership. You can cheat. Okay, source number Dalet. When Laban attacks Yaakov's integrity, and you stole from me, and you weren't a good watchman, Yaakov says, no way. I'm not listening to this false narrative, fake news. Ze esrim shana anochi imcha. And you know what happened, Lavan? If ever there was an attack by a lion or by a team of robbers and thieves, or there was some other natural loss, Anochi Achatanu, I covered it. I wiped it off. Miyadi Tivakshena. Wow, Yehuda's playing a trick on Yehuda. Sorry, Yehuda's playing a trick on Yaakov. Yehuda tells Yaakov, I know what's going to convince you. I'll use the same language you took pride in when you were defending yourself against Laban. Yehuda was eavesdropping, put a little bug in Yaakov's clothing. He recorded Yaakov. Every night he'll listen to Yaakov. Oh, that's what leadership is. Anochi achatenu, miyadi tevakshenu. So when it came crunch time for him to convince Yaakov, he says, Anochi Erevenu Miyadi Tevakshenu. Almost the identical words. Obviously, the context is a little different. So Erevenu has to replace a Hatenu. But it's stunning. whole different form of leadership. That's the first difference. Make sure we don't overshoot our time. Second difference. Oh. One of the most dangerous traits in life is also one of the most important traits. And it's the vitality of that trait that renders it so dangerous. Everyone knows that greed is deplorable, and lust, and avarice, and jealousy is petty, and anger is poisonous. We know. We know when these traits advance that they're dangerous and toxic. Sometimes we're stronger, sometimes we're weaker, sometimes we avoid, sometimes we fail, and we succumb. But we know what we're dealing with. Ambition is very noble, and it's very necessary for human achievement. And very often, ambition weds itself to our noble thoughts and our ideals. We have high-minded ideals, and we're on a mission from God. And we're here to protect the free world, or not, at least the Jewish people. And in that whisper lies the great challenge of ambition. Because very ambitious people cross red lines, and they end up justifying the means to the end. And they don't know it, because their ambitions are just so lofty. And they've convinced themselves, either through internal confidence or a sense of divine mandate or a combination of both, that they need to advance their position, their leadership, their... I've lived long enough to know people like that. People are very aggressive and trying to imply their dreams and their ambitions and their programs and at severe, severe moral cost, having crossed many, many moral red lines. And to a degree, that's what we start to see in Yosef. Again, you can't read Sefer Bereishis Chalila Bachas solely as a literary novel, Chalila Bachas. There are all sorts of kavanos, and these people operated on many, many levels. And myself, a similar bottom means they inhabited celestial spheres of operation and not just the same interactions that we inherit. But the Torah also wants us to read that story. It's not a question of who Yosef was, it's a question of what story the Torah wants us to read. What message does the Torah want to read by articulating the story in a way that would incite or invite the following read? And it's clearly the read of a dreamer who will stop at no cost to impose his dreams on a very unaccommodating world. It's clear that his dreams will come at the cost of other people, and it's clear that those people don't want to pay that price. And he won't stop until those dreams are achieved. Again, I'm not impugning Yosef. I'm impugning a story. This is a narrative the Torah wants us to read and learn. And of course, Yosef had thousands of other reasons, but this is one storyline the Torah wants us to take away. And at a certain point, you ask yourself, what is happening in Parshas Mikra and Vayigash? Why doesn't he tell his father a famous question? And even if you can justify the radio silence while his father is languishing in agony and sadness, but this whole manipulation of his brothers, this whole Machiavellian, it seems outrageous. They're suffering, they're terrified. You can justify trying to elicit their catharsis, you're trying to give them some repentant moment, but at a certain point, it's just, what cost of human lives and human emotions is too high for your ambitions? And I think to his credit, he climbs down from that in Parshas Vayigash. I think when he caves, is that because it's too overwhelming emotionally, because he chooses to cave. He says, this is no longer something I can live with. Doesn't mean he couldn't. I think he made a decision. He couldn't morally hold back. And therefore decided that my sensitivity to my brother's emotions are far more important than whatever ideals and ideologies I'm pursuing. But if you're looking for a portrait of what I like to call a monster of ambition, that's the portrait the Torah wants us to see. Again, I wouldn't use that word about Yosef, Chas v'Shalom. I don't use that word about Yosef HaTzadik. But part of the storyline here is so many people are suffering. Binyamin's suffering, and Yaakov's suffering, and the brothers are suffering. And what dream is so important to warrant all this suffering? What ambition? What ideal? What ideology? These are human beings that are being trampled upon. And Yehuda doesn't dream. Yehuda's leadership, I would call, not dreaming and ambition, but responsiveness. You respond to crisis. You have no predetermined notion of what you are and where you're heading, but you read the situation. He didn't dream about his interaction with Tamar and thereby act based on his preconceived dreams. He had no premonition about what would happen at the grave, or no premonition about what happened in Mitzrayim or his interaction with Yaakov. There's nothing about Yosef that we know about before the events occur. But as the events unfold, he isn't enslaved to predetermined formulas as to who he is and what he should be. But he's flexible enough, and he acts in very different ways, and his range and his versatility is very impressive. He's able to save Yosef's life, and he's able to operate within this very difficult scene with Tamar, and he's able to succeed in convincing Yaakov. He's a jack of all trades. And he isn't a one-trick pony. I'm the leader, and I'm going to be the leader. To a degree, there's a monotonic quality to Yosef. Who's Yosef? He's the leader. What does it mean to be the leader? Wherever he is, he's calling the shots. Whether it's with the brothers, or whether it's in his master's house, or in jail, in Paro, with the brothers again. As Yosef is. You're just hard to pack. Yehuda convinces Yaakov, protects Yosef, is honest, saves the life, attacks it. Very different person. That's versatility. Such an important word. I want to take two words with you from this year to be successful in life. Is it Oved Hashem? Two words that are not typically associated with Avodas Hashem, like Hasmada and Tefillah and Midelis and Anava. Two words that go beyond the classic Musar Svarim. One I've said before, verticality. To see yourself as part of a long lineage of people that came before you. I think it's hard when you live in Chutz Lars, you tend to see yourself as a certain point in space. And now when you're in yeshiva, I hope you feel like you're part of a line, and a lineage, and people that came before you and that built this country and that built our people and people that will come after you. And how will Jewish history be altered when you leave this world? That's an important question. How will the Jewish people be different? The answer to that question could be domestic, could be internal. I will just raise an incredible family of Ovdei Hashem who know Halacha and study Torah and are kind and are gift tzedakah and want to live in Israel. That's a lifetime achievement award. You don't have to do any more than that, but that takes a lot of passion, a lot of sacrifice, a lot of decisions. Second V word is versatility. So many people peg themselves, I'm this, I'm that, I'm that, I'm this. Don't argue for your limitations, they'll become yours. Write that down. Don't argue for your limitations, they'll become yours. Argue against your limitations. Don't say, this is who I am, this is who I'm born. It's such a crippling voice. This is who I am, this is... Always understand whom you're not and how you can become that person, how you can fill yourself out as a person. You see that in Yehuda. Because he's responsive, because he has no predetermined sense of who I have to be. He hasn't pigged himself in, I am the fill in the blank. I'll do what it takes. And if I need to act in this fashion, if I need to find a solution in this manner, it's really a stunning change. How much time do you have? I don't have the time. Okay, just the 2 minutes. The third difference, again, just to complete the profile. And this you don't really see developed in the text. So far this year has been very, very textual. The creator versus the responsibility. And the predetermined dreamer versus the responsive responder, the versatile responder. Yehuda's a Baal Tshuva. Yosef is a tzaddik. And a real leader is someone that understands the dark side of humanity and the weaknesses of human beings. And not someone that challenges, what a challenge, I hope you all feel challenged. But also I hope you feel challenged by people who are real human beings and who are themselves fallible and weak, and we're like you, and we're high schoolers and teenagers and young adults and succumb to pressures and failed and succeeded. And there's a certain calming voice of leadership that although you're being challenged, you know that if you fail to live up to those lofty goals and lofty expectations, life doesn't end. And I feel bad because as much as we try to give it to you as best we can, we had it on steroids because it was a contrast between Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Amital. It was such a stark contrast, and the complementary or the complement of the two created. And Rav Lichtenstein challenges to live beyond human imagination, not to sleep, to learn all day, not to eat, to just challenge our limits, to soar beyond humanity. Imagine that we could finish Shas, that we could know Kala Tara Kula, that we could improve our tefillah, that we could... He just inhabited such a higher realm of not just religious experience, but of human experience, that we all felt challenged. We all felt challenged to rise above whom we were. And Rav Amitel grounded us, and Rav Amitel told us it's all right to be a human being, and it's all right. Remember what we talked about 2 weeks ago? And the ping-pong in between the two was very, very healthy for us. And I hope that we're able to distill those voices. I don't think you have such polarities here in Yeshiva, for better or for worse. And some of it is better, some of it is worse. But I hope that you feel both of those voices. And look inside your heart over the next minute. Listen to what I'm saying. Do you feel challenged, and do you feel comforted? If you only feel one, you're not getting the full message. And you'll be challenged, but at some point, when you fail, all that being challenged will fade. And if you feel too comfortable and too complacent, then you're really static and inert. And are you able to tap into those two voices to say, well, we know who you are and you're human beings. We're not trying to transition you into people that you can't be. We're not trying to push you to a perch or raise you to a perch from which failure will be debilitating. We are trying to slowly and gradually move you to higher ground. And that's what a real leader is, to be able to calibrate those two messages, to raise the standards while still allowing for human experience and real human interaction. And it's Yehuda who's able to, that's because he's a Baal Teshuva, because you never see Yosef failing. Remember, someone once told me a very, very sagacious line about someone. Again, someone was a very popular leader in the Jewish community, and that person said he never really failed. It's unfortunate he never really failed or fell, and you could see it in him. You could see it in his style and his speaking and his messages. And I wish you would have. I know people that I wish would have failed earlier in life, would be more in touch with other human beings and the struggle, and that again, it's a little bit humility to admit your failures, at least to yourself. And I think, to you, I'm not going to give you a list of all my failures, but I hope that the conversations I have with you and other Rebbeim here are real human conversations, that we weren't born with a Shas in our mother's womb, and we struggle to be who we are. We still struggle to define who we are, and that should give you a sense of comfort in your process. I mean, you fail to live up to your expectations, or you're just like us. Anyway, we'll stop here. Have a great week and a half. We'll see you in 2 weeks and Tuesday, starting Moshe Rebbeim. I wouldn't miss Moshe for the world. Especially since my flight is open. Moshe Rabbeinu over 2 weeks. If I'm on the road somewhere, I'll try to record something and put it up somewhere.